welcome to Season 13, Episode 6 of the Ubuntu Podcast. My name's Alan Pope, and I'm here with my good friend, Mark.
Hello, Alan.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm good, thank you.
And also Martin.
Hello. This is a thing we're doing now, is it?
I don't know. It seems to me when Mark got super grumpy two episodes ago, I thought, well, let's keep this going.
I'm driving the next show, so look forward to slights.
Oh, good. So, Mark, what have you been up to this week?
I have been playing Doom 64.
Oh, is that a turn-based strategy game with roguelike elements?
It's not. In fact, it's... You might be familiar with the popular first-person shooter Doom.
For the Commodore 64.
for numerous platforms, in fact. Mm. So Doom 64, I'd always assumed, naively, that it was a port of Doom to the Nintendo 64.
Ah.
It is not, in fact, a port of Doom to the Nintendo 64. It's a whole new game, which is basically a sequel to Doom 2, but not Doom 3, the other Doom 3, which came much later. But no, this is a...
Are we going to have to explain the entire lineage of Doom and all its successors?
I won't bother. I'll just tell you a bit about Doom 64.
Okay, go.
So Doom 64 was released on the Nintendo 64 and then wasn't commercially released again since, until they just released a new Doom game called Doom Eternal, and they thought they'd re-release this for multiple platforms, including PC and Nintendo Switch, which is where I bought it, for about £4 for people who didn't have an N64 to play it on.
Oh, hang on. You're saying, I thought you were talking about the Doom Eternal as being called Doom 64.
No,
you're actually talking about the thing that was on the N64
yes.
has been, remastered and is now available for the Switch and others.
I wouldn't go as far to say it's been remastered. It's been re-released.
Oh, it's still emulation or something?
I don't know if they've just ported the engine or... because I mean, Doom has always been a very portable engine, but the version used on Doom 64 was slightly updated from the ones which were used for the previous games. So there's the cool thing about it is I thought I sort of had my head around what to expect from an old school looking Doom game in terms of, you know, when what would trigger enemies to appear and what sort of things you need to do to solve the puzzles. But because the engine's a bit newer, there's things that happen which I wasn't expecting. So, you know, there's things like enemies now appear out of thin air, which they didn't used to do, and whole rooms might change shape in response to you doing something, and you can shoot switches sometimes, which didn't used to be a thing in Doom games. I found it really enjoyable to actually play through what looks like an old school game, but with some new challenges to it.
So is this an old game that was released some time ago that you are playing for the first time?
Yes.
So you knew this game existed, but this is your first experience of playing it?
I wasn't actually aware that it was a different game. I thought this was the original Doom, but running on the N64. About a month ago, I discovered that it was actually a completely different game.
And how much time have you spent playing this game?
Probably about... 6 or 7 hours so far. I'm not all the way through it. I'm not even halfway through it.
For £4?
That's good value, that, isn't it?
That is good value, yeah.
Wow, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks for that. Let's get on with the show. So last week we mentioned that Ubuntu 20.04 was released with great fanfare and success, and no zero-day bugs or patches were required. Everything was just peachy.
Excellent media coverage, I thought.
Yes, great media coverage. It was all over the news.
I thought the ticker tape parade was a bit much, especially in the current climate.
I did enjoy Taylor Swift's blog post. That was really good.
Hang on, it makes notes.
So let's have a chat about what happened during the development of 2004 that led up to the pinnacle of all Ubuntu releases. And probably the best person to talk about that is someone who worked on the project. Hey, Martin, do you know anyone who worked on the project?
I know 14 people that worked on the project within Correct the desktop answer. Team alone, yes.
So what should people take away from 2004? What's the headline things that if someone said, hey, you're the new guy who looks after Ubuntu Desktop, what's new?
Well, I mean, it sounds a bit gauche now after that introduction, but this is the best Ubuntu desktop release ever. And it's not that in the last 6 months it suddenly became the best Ubuntu desktop release ever. This is the culmination of 2 years of work and also the continuation and finalization of the direction that Will Cook set the project on, you know, when he started shaping things with the team after the 1804 release.
You're too kind, but he's gone now. You can say bad things. It's okay.
he doesn't listen, does he?
No, he doesn't. But it is that, you know, when I took over at the desktop team, Will had already set a lot of the wheels in motion, you know, some of the direction for what is now the 2004 release was down to Will's leadership and the team and the team input and what they wanted to work towards. So it is the continuation of, you know, that period.
Okay, we've got the niceties out of the way. What's the actual stuff people should look out for?
Well, from my point of view, the thing that I'm most pleased with is the way Ubuntu looks now. We set about organizing a sprint with the Yaru team. So that's Mads, Frederick, Carlo and Stuart. They're the principal people there. They're in the community and they make the Yaru theme, which is now for the first time the default theme in an LTS release. It became the default theme from 1810 onwards. And Alan and I were fortunate enough to work with them for a week at a sprint in London in early January. And I think they've done an absolutely amazing job.
But it's not just that week. There's like constant work after that. I mean, I sat in the in that week and they were all super active. We all were. Mm-hmm. But then you don't just get a theme punched out in 1 week in an office.
No.
There's continued refinement. And they've done such a lot of work over the weeks since then. And even right up until today, we were having conversations about, hey, can we squeeze this thing in? And can we just tweak this? We want to make this. And they just constantly want to improve it and make it the best it can possibly be. Because they know that this is a community-maintained theme and all eyeballs are going to be looking at this on release day. Or, sorry, we're looking at this on release day. And so, you know, people will want to give them feedback, no doubt.
Yes. You can't underestimate how important this is. And it was fabulous. We were able to pull together, obviously, the four of them and also members of the Ubuntu design team and the Ubuntu desktop team. And then, you know, layabouts like you and me, Alan, to join in and sort of, you know, clap together pom-poms from the sidelines whilst they did all of this splendid work. But their work is the most visible thing. You know, Ubuntu desktop is our shop window, and it does. And it's not just the desktop. It's not just the point at which the login screen appears that it's Ubuntu. They put the effort in helping us with the boot splash. So we've now got the so-called flicker-free boot, you know, which keeps the OEM vendor logo on the screen through the boot process. And this will be familiar if anyone's booted, you know, a Windows 10 PC, you'll know what that looks like. But they made sure that the styling for the full disk encryption passphrase entries and the spinners and even the slightly off-white color of the logos and everything blended perfectly into the desktop. So that whole visual experience is really tight. And because the Ubuntu design team were involved in that journey, it integrates beautifully with the new backdrop and the mascot and, you know, the folders that were created, which were initially prototyped by our design team, but then Stuart then refined and finessed and turned them into what they are today. So without a doubt, that the fact that it looks so different, but it's still unmistakably Ubuntu, I think is probably the biggest thing about this release, because you can't help but not notice that that's a big change.
Now, Ubuntu is an amalgamation of many open source projects. So obviously the primary one that people are going to see when they see this theme is GNOME. And right. So there's a whole bunch of new stuff in GNOME, right?
Yeah, and similarly, a lot of the new stuff in GNOME 3.36 is around design language, and you know that they reworked the login screen and the lock screen. I think for a lot of people that are familiar with GNOME, that's a big change and lots of welcome improvements there. The one for me that I was just delighted to see land was the do not disturb option in the notifications. I mean, that was something I introduced into Mate desktop in the 1910 cycle, and I was delighted that we delivered that, and I missed horribly once I started using GNOME, so I was so pleased to see that.
So in terms of how these features were developed, were these things that the Ubuntu desktop team worked on and pushed upstream, or is it just fortunate that the GNOME upstream team happened to have worked on lots of wonderful features which we can now take advantage of?
So yes, there's bits of both, right? So I know that things like the lock screen improvements in GNOME have been a multi-cycle upstream GNOME design team initiative. Mm-hmm. I think they first planned this out like 2 years ago, and they've been working on a number of improvements, you know, iteratively over the years. And it's a perfect storm of all of that stuff landing to coincide with an LTS release. But then in terms of what, you know, what we contribute, there's also been some things that the desktop team have been contributing to upstream GNOME as well to try and improve that, you know, GNOME desktop experience.
That login screen stuff landed pretty late in the cycle. It was quite a squish to get that in, as well as the clean boot stuff. It seemed like that was a bit of a surprise, and it was a pleasant surprise, you know, to see that stuff landing. But, you know, obviously we're consuming stuff that's made by lots of open source developers, and mm-hmm. their timelines don't necessarily match up. They wouldn't, you know, they have their own, their own release cycle.
So we do align with the GNOME release schedules. And in fact, when Ubuntu started shipping GNOME, you know, again, in the 1710 cycle, GNOME accommodated us by changing their release cycles to realign with ours, which was, you know, very gracious of them. But nevertheless, you know, there's a lot of moving software there, and it all needs to be harmonized and brought together. And the boot splash stuff, yes, we landed that mostly at the request of our OEM customers. So Dell, Lenovo and HP. This is something where these are specifications that are sort of like standards in the industry as far as they're concerned. And when they choose to ship Ubuntu on their devices, they want the same experience on Ubuntu that they get when they ship their devices with Windows. So that can be everything from something trivial like preserving the OEM logo on the screen for as long as possible during the boot process, to making sure that electromagnetic screen blinds work and things like that, you know, which is, you know, one of the weird things that we're working on at the moment, or that, you know, new standards in audio subsystems work. So there's a couple of new hardware features in Ubuntu 2004 that nobody even knows exist yet. So there's these new audio subsystem one called D-Mic and one called Soundwire. You might have heard of them before, but one, you know, for some, there are no devices on the market that support this stuff yet, but the capability to support this stuff exists in Ubuntu 2004, because we know we need to support devices from the tier one vendors later in the year that use these new chips.
One of the things that a lot of people talk about with GNOME Shell specifically is performance, and it's been a constant iterative process. Would you say 2004 is faster than the previous releases? Measurably, noticeably?
We can definitely say measurably, because Daniel Van Vogt has gone to great lengths to document how those profiling and debugging tools can be used to prove what the levels of latency are that existed in GNOME Shell prior to applying the patches that he's been contributing upstream. So yes, it's measurably faster, but mostly it's about perception, and it's perceivably faster as well, even if some of it is through, you know, tricking the human brain into reducing the latency so things just happen more fluidly, so you don't notice the fact that there's, you know, stuttering in the frame animations and things. But yes, it absolutely definitely is, and Daniel has also got an eye on profiling memory as well. So, you know, when we talk about, you know, reducing the memory footprint of GNOME, Daniel has played his role there, and that work isn't complete. We've already figured out what we're going to be doing in the 2010 cycle, and there will be yet more improvements in the fluidity and low latency experience of the GNOME desktop for places where you didn't even think you'd see the GNOME desktop running, but you will by October in later than a year.
Oh, you tease.
I know.
So one of the things that there was a bit of a hoo-ha about during the recent release cycle was the removal of a lot of 32-bit packages from Ubuntu, and how that might have a knock-on effect on support for gaming. So where have we landed with that in 2004?
So we maintain a subset of the Ubuntu archive as i386 multi-lib libraries. And that's a lot of techno babble for basically we have enough 32-bit library compatibility to support the likes of Steam, Wine, Lutris, your back catalogue of Humble Bundle games, GOG games, printer drivers from the past. You know, we did a fairly broad bit of surveying, and we identified a whole bunch of stuff, and that list of libraries is not frozen. So if we find something significant that is not well supported, then we can, you know, we have the ability to add an additional library or two into the archive in order to support that. But as things stand now, all the big stuff works.
Mm-hmm. So we're talking about someone installing 2004, and they go to install some third-party piece of software that probably we've never heard of, mm-hmm. and it may be some proprietary internal thing they use for their business, right? And nobody's got access to the source code anymore, so they can't just rebuild it against mm-hmm. a new libc. They can't rebuild a 64-bit version. They've got this crusty old 32-bit of software, probably not used by a huge number of people. That's the kind of thing that's likely to break, and it will break in, it may break in some way, mm-hmm. like can't find this library, and when they try and apt install it, that library's gone, and they would need to ask us to bring that library back to life, that 32-bit version back to life, and then I guess the foundations team evaluate whether that's a worthwhile exercise.
Right size the effort involved there. It might be that if it's a single organization that has got their own, you know, bespoke application from the past, then our advice might be let us show you how to use LexD in order to run your application in an 1804 container. And, you know, nobody has to do any additional work at all. Or, you know, maybe they speak to our advocacy team and they say, well, here's how you preserve applications from the past inside a snap, and you could publish that privately for your organization. So, you know, I think.
But it's not the big ticket items. Like you mentioned Steam and Wine and these big ones that people keep worrying about, that, you know, 2004 is getting rid of all this 32-bit stuff. All my old games are not going to work and all this Steam stuff is not going to work. That's not the case.
No, that's that stuff.
And if it does break, that's a bug.
Exactly. If the big stuff breaks, it's a bug. And, you know, we've tried to make sure that, you know, the back catalogue of Unity 3D games, Steam, GOG, Humble Bundle, you know, there's a whole raft of software catalogs there that, as you say, are never going to get rebuilt or recompiled. So we're mindful of that.
On the subject of gaming, because mm-hmm. you mentioned all those gaming platforms, one thing that people are of a certain percentage of the audience who game and use NVIDIA hardware will be keen to have the latest and greatest NVIDIA drivers. Mm-hmm. Is that something that ships and is easy to install and doesn't require PPAs and external scripts and dodgy websites and all that kind of stuff?
Yes. So in 1910, we introduced the NVIDIA drivers into the image itself. So when you install Ubuntu, if you tick the box in the installer that says, give me third-party software, which is labeled as may include Wi-Fi and graphics drivers, if you tick that box and you've got an NVIDIA graphics card, it will install the NVIDIA proprietary drivers. So on first boot of the installed system, you're up and running with the NVIDIA drivers pre-installed. So we've done a bit of work to improve that. There's a couple of things where we've improved. First of all, FFmpeg in the archive is now ENVENC enabled. And I actually did that work as a pet project over the course of a weekend. So that means that if you want to encode video on the GPU, that is now a built-in capability of FFmpeg. And that also means it's a built-in capability of anything that uses FFmpeg, like OBS Studio and Shotcut Video Editor. So, you know, if you want to do game streaming, not only do you have drivers out of the box and Steam works now because we provide all of those libraries, but you get all of that hardware acceleration as well. But then there's a couple of other features that are built into 2004 that gamers may enjoy. One is game mode, which is a service that runs, well, it's actually activated on demand from Feral Interactive. So all of Feral's titles hook into this, and it tunes the CPU governors and the I/O schedulers to optimize for gaming. So that's something that we've built into 2004.
And is that bundled on the CD? Is that like installed, or is it in the archive?
No,
and you have to go and get it?
It's in the system by default, and it's Dbus activated. So if there's a game that's game mode capable, so things like Lutris or the games from Feral and a number of others, they will automatically look for that Dbus service and request that enhancement, and it will just get turned on by default. There's no messing around. It just,
you don't have to do anything.
No, just gets turned on.
Nice. So we're running a bit low on time.
Mm-hmm.
So just a couple things I wanted to round up on. One thing is the experimental ZFS support that went into 1910.
Yes.
That's obviously also in 2004, but it's not the default, right?
Correct. The ZFS is not the default file system. It's still labeled experimental. The big new feature is that there's now this system called, this component called ZSys, which we developed in the desktop team. So now if you do apt installs or distribution upgrades, it will take snapshots prior to those actions happening. So if something terrible happens, you'll automatically get a restore point in the grub menus. So you can do big upgrades, big application installs, reboot, and if it's all a big fat mess, you can choose in the boot menu, restore me to this point, please. And that's a starting point which we're going to build other backup capabilities on in the future.
Ooh.
Mm.
Tease.
I know.
it's all about the tease. And the other thing that's worth mentioning is people are talking a lot about this secure kernel thing called WireGuard. What is it?
Right. WireGuard is a modern take on VPNs, and it has made it into the mainline kernel, but we're shipping the 5.4 kernel in this initial release of 2004. So with the blessing of the upstream author of WireGuard, we are shipping a backported WireGuard in the 5.4 kernel. So that's there, not a DKMS module, actually baked into the kernel. and through our hardware enablement releases in the next 1804 point release, WireGuard will also be baked into that kernel as well.
Backporting WireGuard from mainline to 2004 that's on 5.4 mm-hmm. and then back to 1804. And interesting.
So, because
normally we don't add features to old releases, and people think that, oh, everyone just upgrades and nobody runs those old crusty releases. I mean, 1804 was only 2 years ago and has
right.
years of support left in it, but people see it as a crusty old release.
So what we also do is we provide hardware enablement kernels. So each time there's a new interim release, the kernel and the Mesa stack and the graphics driver stack from that interim release get ported back into the next point release of the LTS. So if you choose to opt into those point releases, then you get all of that additional hardware enablement. So that's how we're delivering WireGuard through HWE to past versions of Ubuntu. And to segue with that, one of the things we're going to be doing is from 2004, if you've got a certified OEM device, so something that is from Dell, Lenovo, or HP that is certified by them and comes pre-shipped with Ubuntu, but perhaps you bought that model with another operating system, if you install the general release of Ubuntu on one of those devices now, you will get the hardware enablement stack for that certified device. You won't just get the general release version, you'll get all of the hardware tuning and everything that's required for that device to function correctly. So perhaps specific firmware or drivers or power endurance profile configuration that device needs to be at its best.
Nice. Well, we are wrapping this up with, I guess, a call to everyone to try 2004 out and let us know your experience. What the things that went well for you? Did you install clean? Did you upgrade? How was that process, the install upgrade? Did you try any of this new stuff out? You trying out WireGuard, trying out ZFS, all this kind of stuff? We'd look forward to hearing all about your experience with 2004. And now it's time for Command Line Love. I can't do that. Mark, did we get this sent to us? Was this one you came up with?
This was a request from one of my colleagues to talk about something which I did at work. So we have a command line tool which we use for, we basically one of our team wrote and we maintain between us to make it easier to use our slightly clunky issue tracker system. And it has lots of options which involve typing in long strings about sort of team names and iteration names and so on, which the issue tracking system knows about, but our computer doesn't know about. And I wanted to come up with a way to auto-complete these things. And I came across a tool in Bash called Complete, which is very well named. And there's several ways of using it. You can use it with the W flag, where you give it a list of words and your command. And then if you type your command followed by the start of one of those words and hit Tab, it'll find the best match in the list and it'll auto-complete it for you. You can also do it with a Bash function. So if you've got a function defined in your shell, then you type the command followed by a partial argument, hit Tab, it then calls that function and does something to return an auto completion. But another one, which is even cleverer, is you can actually have it call any command, including the command that you're auto completing. So you can type your command and then you type part of an argument and press Tab, and then it will call your command with that partial argument, and then your script can use the things it knows about, which the Bash shell doesn't know about, to look up what you might be trying to say and then give you an auto-completion.
None of that made sense to me. I'll be honest with you. But I would be keen to hear if anyone else has heard about Complete and has actually used it. I will give it a try. I don't quite know how.
If you've got a bash script which takes arguments,
right,
then that's a good place to start thinking about how you might make it autocomplete for you.
Okay, I'll give it a go. Thank you very much, Mark, and your colleagues. The command line love for this week, Complete. And now it's time for all your wonderful feedback. As ever, we do read all your emails, but we can't read them all out, I'm afraid. Some of them this week have been very long. Thank you very much. First up, friend of the show, Stuart Langridge, mentioned in our Telegram channel, ubuntupodcast.org/telegram.
I think the difference between the current crop of Linux phone vendors and previous attempts is that the current ones are small enough that they can be largely self-sustaining without huge mass market uptake, and they're okay with that. Canonical, and even more so Intel and Nokia, did not want a device which sold 10,000 a year. It's not a big enough deal for them. I don't think that's the case with PinePhone or Vola. If they sell 10,000 devices, they'll consider that an enormous success and be happy with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're probably right there.
Yeah, I had a conversation with the UB Ports guys at UbuCon last year, and I was saying, you know, embrace your niche. You have a niche audience, and you can be successful in that niche with that group of people that are passionate about what it is you do and be satisfied with that and serve them well.
Yeah. Kai emailed show@ubuntupodcast.org.
Kai says, I am known for the Ubuntu Lumina project. When I heard the mention on the show, it really warmed my heart. I am especially new to this whole thing, and I have been enjoying crashing every 2 minutes because it forces me to learn something new. The main issues that really have been catching my boot is deb packaging. Sadly, packaging a desktop environment is different than packaging any other package, but I've been having fun trying, and this whole project has been a fun mess.
Yes, I've been seeing some of the rants that Kai has been posting both in Telegram and in blog posts about how frustrating it is. I can only imagine. I've only done Debian packaging of fairly simple stuff, like I used to package the note-taking app Tomboy in a PPA. And the amount of effort just to package that one application for a bunch of different releases of Ubuntu whenever it was updated was a surprising amount of work. I can't imagine all the moving parts to do an entire desktop environment.
Yeah. So my advice on tackling packaging a desktop would be this. Get close to the upstream team and understand what the prescribed build order for the desktop environment is. And once you know what that order is, document it. And when you revise the packaging, revise it in build order and build those packages in build order and submit them to a PPA in build order. So it's a bit like stacking bricks on top of one another. You build the first thing, you put that in the PPA, and when that successfully builds, you build the next thing with the new version and so on. And over time, you can get really quick at doing that because it becomes quite fluent. But understand the build order. It's the most important thing to packaging desktop environments. You can't just go throwing packages around left, right, and center because you get into circular dependency. And it's a big fat mess, as you described.
Manjaro ARM developer Dan emailed about the PinePhone.
For such a cheap device, you get pretty good hardware. It feels like a good phone. It has a good size. It's thinner than the Librem 5. The hardware is no near a flagship device. The hardware is nowhere near a flagship Android device, but it was never intended to be. Since I am a developer, I use it as a development device, so I don't use it as a daily device. We focus on the Plasma mobile interface for now, and it's mostly working. I could probably switch to a Linux-only device if I can live without my banking app. New apps for Linux mobile are popping up all the time. They just need time to get ready and be tested enough for daily use.
Thank you, Dan. It's really nice to get feedback from people who are actually, you know, on the coalface developing on these devices that, you know, we ramble on about on this this show. Thanks for that. That's all of your lovely feedback. that's it for episode 6. We'll be back next time with some more news and community news and events. We haven't had a huge number of events recently, so if you have some events you think we should mention, I appreciate a lot of them are not going to be in person, but there's a whole lot of virtual events and education stuff and training stuff going on for self-improvement while people are sitting at home. So if you learn of any of those, do feel free to pass them on to us. You can send us an email, show@ubuntupodcast.org, or you can send us via Twitter. We are @UbuntuPodcast on Twitter. Thanks everyone for listening, and we'll see you all next time.